Okay, I hope you can. Okay, not more than that. Good. Good afternoon. Welcome to the second last lecture this term. One more next week on corpus linguistics. So this is today's topic is basically interactive English. Things to do with spoken language, but more sort of the organization of spoken language, the kind of routines that we find in spontaneous interaction. Okay. Yes, there is a handout coming around which you'll need to follow a recording in about 10 minutes or 5 minutes. I will also put this as a PDF online, so those of you who are not here can have this. It's one page only, or rather it's a double page to two-sided handout. Okay? Right, just a few comments, a few aspects of general admin. I have now received the feedback from you that you were asked to submit electronically. As you know, we have this scheme at the university whereby all the courses, well, not all the courses, but about half of the courses are evaluated. The return is not extremely good. There are over 300 people who could have done this, but as so often, particularly with lecture courses, not that many people actually did this. Many thanks to those who did. I think it was about 69 people. Okay. So it's, well, I've been told that this is not bad for a sort of online survey. It's not ideal. Last year I also asked, I had my own survey which I might put up again, which is also electronic, where you could then let me know a bit more about how you felt about this lecture. I also thought that it might be interesting for you to see what other people thought, so I'm just going to upload the PDF that I got, which summarizes all the feedback. Generally speaking, you seem to be quite okay with the lecture. You can't always make everyone happy. Obviously, some of the comments sort of contradict each other. While someone wants X, the other person doesn't want X. So that's I guess, life when you deal with 300 people, or 69. Anyway, so, I mean, if you're interested, you can have a look at that, and there might be additional feedback or an additional feedback session. Then, those of you who have submitted the second assignment, haven't been told the results yet, they will be uploaded over the weekend, together with the with some sample answers, certainly for the first six questions, and there will be keywords for the essay questions, sort of what should have been mentioned or what was good when it was mentioned. I may also scan in one or two very good responses that I got, sort of to give you an idea of what would really be expected. Okay. You're also probably waiting for a little bit more information about the exam. This is actually only taking place for those of you who are signing up for this at the beginning of April, so there is time still. You will get information about where to go, which rooms, and we will probably split you up into, I don't know, A to M, and the rest of the alphabet goes into the other room, or something like that. All of those things will be communicated to you via email. I would also offer a little bit more preparation for you, or opportunity for preparation, beyond beyond the office hours that I, of course, have. I did this last year, and about 25 or 30 students or so actively took part in a chat session on StudIP where they could ask questions. It was probably much more stressful for me to do that than standing in front of you and talking, because sort of 10 people were asking questions at the same time, and it was even quite difficult to sort of moderate this, but I'm happy to do this again. There will also be a couple of more exercises and pieces of homework, which I will, I mean not homework in the sense that you have to do it, but things that should help you prepare for the exam a little bit more throughout the semester break And yes, and if there are any questions about aspects of the exam, you're always also welcome to email me. Okay, that's as much as I wanted to do in terms of admin, and I'd like to move over to linguistics now. And I'd like to start with a bit of Calvin and Hobbes again. Mm-hmm. This is maybe a little bit too... Well, one of the comments which I got from the in the feedback was, don't dim the room so much, it makes me sleepy. Okay. Yes, I know, but I don't know. Can you read this or should I dim it more? Dim it more? Yes? Okay. All right. I mean, those anyway. Don't fall asleep. Okay. Ah. Again, too much. Okay. All right. So, we'll leave it at that. Okay? Good. Right. I'll read it to you anyway. When a person pauses in mid-sentence to choose a word, that's the best time to jump in and change the subject. It's like an interception in football. You grab the other guy's idea and run the opposite way with it. The more sentences you complete, the higher your score. The idea is to block the other guy's thoughts and express your own. That's how you win. And then Hobbes says, conversations aren't contests. Okay, point for you, but I'm still ahead. Okay. So, I'll just make this one tiny bit brighter. Okay. No! So, let's leave it there. Okay, yeah. Right, so, one of the things that I'd like to discuss with you today, or look at today, even if only implicitly in some ways, is whether conversations are contests or not, or to what extent what we see in interactioning or happening in interaction, in the way we talk to each other, particularly in spontaneous conversation, can be likened to, or is a bit like contests in some way or other. Okay. So, this is all under the heading of conversation or discourse analysis. And in fact, I'd like to mention those terms a little bit at the beginning, because you will find, or not mention them, but introduce them or introduce the differences between the two, because you will find them in textbooks and you will find them in the literature referred to in different ways. When people did discourse analysis in the traditional sense a while back, they were doing, well, the following. They were basically looking at what they had been doing for decades or perhaps even centuries in terms of looking at syntax, at sentences, okay? The structure of sentences, the syntax of sentences. And they were just basically asking, can something like this be extended beyond the sentence boundary? Okay? We've done a little bit like that, a little bit of that in the text linguistics session, but the question was, can we extend this to spoken language proper, to interaction proper? So discourse is just a string of sentences, and we can look at how they belong together, and then sort of make sense of what's happening there. Typically also, people who did this were working on constructed data, on sort of intuition-based approach. They were thinking about what people could do when they communicate with each other, rather than looking at long stretches of what actually happens in conversation. So they were not really producing quantitative findings or quantitative analyses, which is something that we'll be talking about next week, but they were looking at one or two texts, possibly constructed, and then trying to make sense of them in some way or other. Well, in some way or other, in the sense of as if they were sentences, well, basically the grammar of texts. Okay? So the basic unit would have been the speech act rather than the sentence. Okay? And the question was, can we come up with some kind of syntax of speech acts? This is not the approach that you find very typically today. Okay? But what they basically try to do is they try to find some kind of, well, ideas how something can be well-formed or not. Okay? So well-formed sequences rather than ill-formed sequences or incoherent discourse. Okay? I'll demonstrate what I mean by this in a minute. Then there was conversation analysis. This is a different approach in the sense that it is empirical. So we're looking at real data, we're also looking at more data. Okay? So it's observation-based, because people believe that intuition, and I'll make that point very forcefully next week, believe that intuition is unreliable. Intuition in the sense of thinking, sitting back in a, let's say, in an armchair and thinking about language and making things, well, wondering how language can be used. That this is some, this is an approach which is relatively unreliable. Okay. What people in conversation analysis wanted to do was to discover systematic properties of the, and here's a bit of a complex term, sequential organization of talk. And I'll show what I mean by this in a minute. Now, just to make, to compare those type of approaches, conversation analysis versus discourse analysis, have a look at this exchange here. I have a 14-year-old son. Well, that's all right. I also have a dog. Oh, I'm sorry. Is that ill-formed? Is that in any way odd? Can you make sense of this? Yeah?
Why should we apologize for the for age and
all? Okay, yes, why should we do this? This is sort of odd, yeah, okay. Okay, yes, that's the next thing that I have here. Needs context. Can you create a context where this makes perfect sense? Yeah, possibly. Okay, yes. I mean, there's no... Yes? Exactly. Yes, that's it. I mean, that's the one that I had in mind, or that's the one that the discourse analysis had in mind, possibly, when they created this interchange. This is actually some kind of... it's an artificial interchange, okay, or conversation. But I think that shows quite nicely the idea of whether something is ill-formed or not doesn't really depend so much on the actual utterances themselves and how they relate to each other, but also very much on the context. So, yes, this is about renting a flat, and having children is fine, but having pets is not. I'm sorry. Okay. And suddenly it makes sense. Something that looked very ill-formed before suddenly makes perfect sense. Okay. So these are the sort of the two general approaches, conversation versus discourse analysis. However, today, when you read them in read about them in textbooks or read about them in scientific literature, you might actually get different people referring to the same thing with either term or vice versa. So it's a bit of a mess. And this is why I wanted to start the lecture with trying to sort of give you the original or the traditional view so that you can make sense of what you might find in books. Okay. Today's lecture is largely concerned with spontaneous conversation. Okay. There are also interesting questions one can ask about non-spontaneous or, interactions that happen in a, for example, institutional context. Think about it. We are now interacting in some way. Okay. But we're, of course, interacting in a very different way from when you meet me out on the street and, we have a quick chat about the weather or something like that. So I'm more interested currently in how the kind of conversations would work when we meet out on the street. Okay. Right. Some questions that can be asked in this context. Okay, we just heard about the theatre group. They're presenting a play. They know what they're saying. They know what they're saying ahead of the play. They've rehearsed things. They have their parts, and there is a script. Okay. Now, what happens on stage, I guess, will make perfect sense. It'll be coherent. It'll be funny, and all sorts of things. Okay. However, when we speak, we also typically are coherent. We are often funny. Conversations don't usually break up because people don't know what to say anymore. It is also in many ways very ordered, okay? As if there was a script. How does this work? How do we know, for example, when to stop, when someone else wants to start speaking? It's certainly not an anything-goes situation. There must be some kind of rules. But they're not rules that are very strictly enforced in the sense that, for example, the situation is enforced in Parliament. Remember the extract that I played last time where we had speakers who were not allowed to just start speaking whenever they wanted to speak, but they actually had to be given permission by the speaker in the Parliament. They were assigned their turns, and they couldn't address each other, but they basically had to address the speaker in order to communicate. The situation in spoken language, in spontaneous spoken language, is very different. But still, it's not just anything goes. Yes, some situations are more regulated than others. I've already mentioned the classroom or the courtroom, the kind of institutional setting. Okay. If you started talking now, more loudly than some of you sometimes do, then this would be a violation of the kind of rules that exist in the current institutional setting. I'm supposed to have the floor, you're supposed to listen. Okay. That is what is a regulated speech situation. Okay. It could also be regulated in other ways. For example, in certain, and I think that's mentioned in the reading also in Finnegan, in certain societies, who is allowed to speak when also very much depends on their social status, their age, etc. But as I said, today we'll be concerned with conversation that is spontaneous. And I would like to play you a very spontaneous conversation that was recorded quite a while back. This is an extract on channel crossing. Well, channel crossing the channel between, crossing the channel between Britain and the continent. Okay, or Europe, as the Brits would say. Okay. And what I would like you to do is sort of approach this in a very naive way. Just follow the conversation, try to understand what they're saying. You've got the thing on your handout. But while doing this, already start listening to who says what when. Okay. The content is not so important, but more importantly, when does one person stop? When does the next person start? Are the people completely quiet while the other person speaks? Is there anything happening to help the person who currently speaks go on? Are there interruptions? What's the organization of this? Okay. This is a bit more than a minute. I'll play this once now. I'll then talk about several aspects that are related to this type of extract and some others. And then at the end of the lecture, I will play it again.
And so, channel crossing.
So it was lovely hour one with the nightclub, and we had a soup cabin which was just below the nightclub. Utterly soundproof. You know, when you think what ours is like, when we shut our cabin door, even though there was anything outside, there was a nightclub, pounding music going, just one, immediately overhead, and we were the cabin next to it, and you couldn't hear it at all. And of course, we could save the children, we'd just be upstairs, and they knew they'd just have to put their dressing gown on and come up and say, I'm upstairs. So that was super.
Every summer, you see stories of tremendous queues.
Let me go to books.
Mind you, last summer was a weekend where the queues were so bad that even people were booked from the
It was something to do with strike,
wasn't it? Yeah, there was some trouble as well.
But certainly, in the past, we just roamed up. If we go Southampton, no harm, no shame, then we book. And I do wonder what was happening. For example, there are often people who broke down, for example, so they missed their booking, or the child has been ill, so they stopped somewhere and they missed their booking, and those people have to wait for a vacancy. And the years we've been there, they've got on usually. There haven't been masses of people waiting to get on. But when the year that we did break down, we were actually booked back across from Bologna. Calais, and we just drove out and got onto the boat.
Okay. I mean, obviously, this is not the kind of well-ordered speech situation as in, let's say, well, I was about to say in Parliament, what we heard about wasn't very well-ordered last week either, but let's say in a lecture. This is not this kind of, well, very straightforward, one person talks and everyone else is quiet situation. But at the same time, I think it's also true to say that this isn't chaos either. This is fairly ordered. Very, very often, only one person speaks at a time. Just some observations, and some of them will be terribly trivial. Okay? This is something which is in a way obvious, but sometimes one has to start from the obvious in order to make more advanced observations. Okay. Speaker change occurs or recurs. Yes, of course. It's not just one speaker. One person says something, then stops or just about stops, and the other person takes over. But still, while this happens, it's usually only one person who speaks at a time. There was some overlap. There were some people sort of trying to start speaking at the same time, but very quickly this is usually resolved. These are four people talking to each other. It's two couples, one couple that's been on holiday together and telling them about what's happened during their channel crossing. The other very obvious fact is that turn size is variable. The amount available to someone when they want to say something isn't 13 and a half seconds, but it depends. Okay. On what it depends is a question, is an open question. It's not determined in advance, and even though it is not determined in advance, the next person, once the person has stopped who's currently got the floor, seems to have little problems starting pretty much immediately when the previous speaker has stopped. Also, of course, content is not specified in advance, and the topic which may be set, may be changed, may be developed over time, may be going in whatever direction that the speakers choose. So, these are fairly basic observations, okay, some of them very basic, for example, that speaker change occurs. But one should now, I think, go back and ask whether there are any rules that regulate this. So, are there any rules for turn-taking? Referring to the fact that I'm holding the floor, that I'm speaking for a while, and then passing on the right, perhaps, if that's what the speaker does, of the turn of the floor to the next person, whose turn it then is to speak. Now, this is something that was described for the first time in a famous paper in 1974. Sachs and others, Sachs, Shegloff, and Jefferson. They call it the simplest systematics for the organization of turn-taking for conversation. That's a fairly complex paper. It's a long paper with a lot of transcriptions of events, of speech events. But in a way, they make some very simple observation, and that's why they called it a simplest systematics. And that's what I would like to summarize here for the next few minutes. They basically came up with the following turn-taking rules. And yes, they are in a way obvious, but still. The first rule is, or 1A, the current speaker may select, that is, choose, who will be the next speaker. I'll give you examples of all these in a minute. If that's not happening, if the current speaker doesn't select the next speaker, then another speaker, among the people who are communicating with each other, may self-select. And if that doesn't happen, then typically the speaker who spoke first, okay, the current speaker, who still has the turn, may, but need not, continue speaking. And they will typically continue speaking because, as I will say later on in the lecture, silence in communication is problematic. Okay? If you talk to someone, suddenly stop speaking, and the other person stops speaking as well, then this is awkward. Now, these three general, very, very basic rules apply sort of in a circular fashion. Rules A1, AB, and A, no, not A. 1A, 1B, or 1C continue to apply at every possible transition relevance place until speaker transfer occurs. What is a transition relevance place? Well, that's some way of signaling that if you, for example, as the conversational partner, want to start speaking, now would be the time to do so. This sort of suggests that this is not everywhere in conversation. Not at any time can another speaker start speaking. There must be certain signals which let the conversational partners know, yes, now it's time to start speaking. Transition relevance places are difficult to see in the sense of it's not as if there was one particular feature which makes a transition relevance place, or TRP, as it is sometimes abbreviated. Okay. But let's see, maybe we'll find a few hints as to what constitutes a transition relevance place. I said I was going to exemplify them. Let me do that now. That's 1A. Current speaker may select, that is, choose who will be the next speaker. It's very similar to the example that we've had in pragmatics. Can you tell me the time? Just I've added John to it. Basically, there's maybe John and Mary. In linguistics, it's always John and Mary. Maybe it's John and Mary in the room, and I would like John to say something. Can you tell me the time, John? I am selecting the next speaker, and John then tells me, well, the milkman has come. Okay, so this would be a very simple speaker selection. Current speaker selects next. If that doesn't happen, then the second speaker may self-select. I bought a new car yesterday. Oh, did you? What color is it? So there is no overt indication that the other person has been sort of asked to start speaking now. It's basically a self-selection on the basis of the fact that speaker B thinks, well, it's probably time for me to say something now. There was a transition relevance place. If no other participant self-selects a next speaker, current speaker may but need not continue speaking. So I bought a new car yesterday. B doesn't say anything. There is an awkward silence. But in fact, the awkward silence is only probably going to last a second or so, because the first speaker, the current speaker, will continue speaking and will say, for example, well, the old one was about to die. Okay, very basic in a way, but the important questions now follow. How, for example, do we identify this transition relevance place? How do we know when a speaker has finished their term? Well, obviously meaning helps. Is something complete? If it's complete, or at least complete enough for me to have a feeling that that person has sort of finished a thought, then this might be a sign that I can start speaking. But there are also formal signals. For example, the intonation contour. Yeah? I mean, when I speak, then I constantly have not just what we looked at in phonetics, certain sounds, but they are connected in some way that, well, there is prosody in this, in the way I speak. It's a question of contour. Well, there's an element of how the pitch moves, etc. So you basically feel when something is, for example, finished, or when a question has been put. So intonation will play an important role, but sometimes people slow up. So, for example, I may, well, not like this, but do you want to come to dinner tomorrow or something like that? So I may lengthen a syllable, and that may be an indication that I'm happy to give you the floor. I may actually look at my conversational partner, something that I may not have done for a while. So this also may signal you're allowed to speak now. The way I, certain gestures, body posture, etc. Or I may just inhale in such a way that the other person hears that. All of this can be, doesn't necessarily have to, but can be interpreted as contributing towards creating a transition relevance place. This is a fairly abstract concept, but there are additional regularities which contribute towards our knowledge of when something is finished. And one extremely important structure of conversation, which really is responsible for a lot of regularity, is this concept of adjacency pairs. Okay? So two elements which are adjacent, next to each other, which have something to do with each other. So here is a typical adjacency pair. How old are you? The answer, 21. So this is a question-answer pair. If we ask a question, then we expect a response. Trivial, yes. We might have a greeting that is then calling for another greeting. If I say, hi, how are you? Then the other person is not just supposed to say nothing, but will probably also be expected to greet you back. Okay. Or an announcement that is then followed by a receipt of the message that is given. Now these are typically called typed pairs in the sense that they are very regular. Okay. They are really very, very common in our turn-taking system, and they order the way we speak to a very large extent. There are expectations that are then fulfilled. If I ask the question, then you will fulfill it with a response or with an answer to that question. Sometimes that's not the case, and then we need additional elements to fix things, so to speak. Can I have a bottle of scotch, please? And then, are you 21? Is that an adjacency pair? Well, not really. It's not the expected response to this, right? But that's exactly the point. A then goes on to say, no, I'm not 21, okay? And in some countries, that means that they can't buy a bottle of scotch, okay? And then we have, sorry, no, as the response. Is there an adjacency pair? Well, yes. In a way, there are two. There is one in the middle. Are you 21? That's a question, and we get a response. No. We also have the first one. Can I have a bottle of scotch? Is that immediately responded to? No. There is what's commonly known as an insertion sequence. Mm-hmm. Something is inserted to explain to explain to the conversational partner why B cannot provide the expected response. So usually, can I have a bottle of scotch, please, would be a speech act asking for, a request, okay, and that would then be either complied with or rather said, responded with no. Okay. But at that stage, when it is uttered, the person is not in a position to decide whether they want to do this or not. So additional work is required, which is again in the form of an adjacency pair, question-response. I'll give you another example. Do you want to test the potatoes? What does this mean? Is this a question? Is this a question about the, do you want to in the literal sense? Probably not. It's a speech act. Okay, please do that. Okay, it's a request in the form of a question. Okay. And then H says, this is wife and husband, I guess. This is a really interesting article about racism in the police force. They're saying there's got to be a massive education campaign to change the way people think. What does that mean? We basically have the situation now that there is a request which was probably understood by the husband, and we have a response here which really is very irrelevant. We will make it relevant through the cooperative principle, but that's not necessarily what the wife does. She assumes, she takes up what the husband says, there certainly has. Yeah, and then the wife just says, potatoes? Fork. Okay. So he gives up. Okay. So what's this? This is, in a way, also some sort of insertion sequence on the basis of the fact that we assume that a request will really will require something, a response or sort of a fulfillment of the request. We make sense of what this means in a pragmatic sense, saying, I don't really want to do this, but the speakers go on, she repeats the request, and then the adjacency pair is, okay, I'll do it. So sometimes things can be more complex, but still the assumption is that the first part of a pair will require the second part. This is actually that we also see something that we also see in this brief exchange. Let's see, you might just be able to see this. I'll read it out to you. And just to make the point again that conversations are typically structured on the basis of our assumption that there are adjacency pairs. This is in a store, in a shop. Someone wants to buy something. Or rather, this is probably a phone conversation, actually. So let me just read this to you. B and A. Okay. B wants to buy something. I ordered some paint from you a couple of weeks ago, some vermilion. A acknowledges that. Yeah? And I wanted to order some more. The name's Boyd. Yes, how many tubes would you like, sir? And what's the price now with VAT? Do you know? I'll just work that out for you. Thanks. Then there is a pause of 10 seconds. £3.19 a tube, sir. £3.19, is it? Yeah. Just a thing. That's what, 319. That's for the large tube, isn't it? Well, yeah, it's a 37 CCS. I'll tell you what. I'll just ring you back. I have to work out how many I need. Sorry, I wasn't sure of the price. You see, okay. Now, when I read this out, this doesn't sound very natural, but you can imagine that this is a typical kind of conversation that happens on the phone. Someone wants to buy something, needs further information. But can we look at the structure of this in the context of the kind of typed pairs, the adjacency pairs that I've just introduced? Okay. We can, for example, say that the first one up here is a request. Okay. I wanted to order some more, the name's Boyd. Okay. Then the second, the shop assistant will ask how many, will ask the first question. Okay. Is the first question answered? Well, no, it is actually responded to with a second question, which is not what we would expect from the standard question-answer typed pair. And then actually the person needs time to work this out, so puts it on hold, which is actually accepted by the conversational partner. So you could say that hold and accept are a typed pair as well. I'll work this out for you. Yeah, sure, take your time. What do we get next? We get A2, namely the answer to the question 2. So we have, in a way, up here, we have question 2 answered by answer 2 with an insertion sequence that is a hold that is followed by an accept. But that still isn't everything. We then get a third question, which is immediately responded to. In fact, we get a fourth question. That's for the large tube, isn't it? Yes. Now, do we ever, because all of this has actually happened, and we still haven't got a response to Q1. That's still sort of floating around, in a way. The expectation is still there that we need a response to question 1. Does it ever happen? No, it doesn't. Okay. But something needs to happen. If there was no response at all, something wouldn't be right. Because we're still expecting that we're receiving a response to the initial question. But what we get is not an actual response, but more an explanation of why the speaker cannot provide a response to the question. So we can in a way say that the whole conversation is put on hold for a while. Well, not actually on hold because people continue communicating, but the response to the first question is either given. If it is given, fine, but if it's not given, then it needs to be explained why it's not given. And all of this is on the basis of the assumption that we know that a question requires a response or an answer. Yeah. So it's not just immediately adjacent elements that are relevant, but it's actually something that may have an impact on the longer stretches of conversation. So adjacency pairs as very important aspects of ordering the conversation. Sometimes when you ask a question or perform a request or something like that, then, well, you have a choice between complying with the request or you'd rather not do it. Okay. So let me just give you one where the situation is that the speaker actually complies. The child may say something, this actually it's rather rare that this happens, but anyway, could you put out the light for my room, please? Okay, so request. Usually it's the other way around, leave the light on. And the father says, sure. Fine. Okay. This is, again, an adjacency pair, and the second part of it, the response, is actually the response that the child wants. Okay. Have a look at this. I wonder whether there is any chance of seeing you tomorrow sometime, half a second break, pause, morning or before the seminar, and then the response after 1 second, I doubt it. Mm-hmm. The reason is I'm seeing Elizabeth. Okay. Now, can the person up there in the corner on the right-hand side please stop talking? Yes, you. Okay. Either outside or listen. Okay. I really mean it. Thank you. Good. The thing that I wanted to ask in this context is, there is a pause of 1 second. Whose pause is it? Whose floor is it at that time? Whose turn is it? Mm-hmm.
It's ours.
So in a way I transcribed this wrongly, right? Yeah. Does it mean something that R produces a pause of 1 second? Yes, one could interpret, because what is R producing? He or she is producing a dispreferred response. C wants to see the person after the seminar, okay, but R has to say, no, sorry, I can't because I'm seeing someone else. Okay. Now, this is signaled to some extent, or this is helped by the signal that there is a pause. Okay. So this preferred responses typically contain, I say typically, it doesn't mean that you can't just say, no, I don't want to see you. Okay, but then that's probably rather unusual. Okay. Typically, it is accompanied by pauses, by these kind of sort of prefaces, oh, well, that sounds nice, but I really ought to do something else than going to the pub with you, or sort of explanations of why it is impossible. All of these elements first have to be produced, and then there might be the actual act of refusing, which the actual component of sorry, I can't. The component of actually saying sorry, I can't. Okay. Now, this actual act of refusing is in a way mitigated, okay, not made as strong. The force of that is reduced in various ways, typically, partly because of the delays and pauses in the accounts that are given. The speaker is in a way already given sort of a head warning, something is going to happen, you're not going to like it. Okay. But then even in the actual set of refusing or expression of refusing, there might be additional ways of lowering the blow of the negative force. I'll give you another example. Do you want to come out to the pub tonight? Now I put the pause in the correct speaker turn. Oh, well, thanks, but I have to wash my hair tonight, so no, I can't make it tonight. Silly example, yes, I know, but just to make the point, we've got the well, thanks, but, okay, explanation why not, and then only at the end do we find, so no, I can't make it tonight. Now, of course, these are constructed examples as well, okay, but what I'm basically explaining or describing here is something that you will find when you look at lots and lots of spoken interactions happening quite regularly. But I think in the introductory lecture one, I've already given you those examples here. God, isn't this picture awful? You remember that one, I think. Silence. Well, that person actually has a turn. We're working on the assumption that this is an adjacency pair. This is a statement which requires some kind of response or take up from on the part of the conversational partner. The fact that it's not given signals something on the assumption that we know that something should be there. I'm getting fat. Silence means agreement. So, A is the first part of an adjacency pair. Good, so we had adjacency pairs, we had the communicative impact of pauses, we had dispreferred versus preferred responses. Let's have a look at another feature that is very common in spoken interaction, namely that of repairs, of fixing something that went wrong in conversation. Okay. Give you an example here at the outset. She was giving me all the people that were gone this year. I mean, this quarter, you know. Yeah. Is there any repair here? Well, yes, there is, in the sense that A, while speaking, while it is his or her turn, realizes that something was produced that wasn't accurate, that wasn't the right word. Giving me all the people that were gone this year. Oh, no, it wasn't this year, actually, it was this quarter. Okay. Fixes this very quickly, fixes it herself, himself. This is a self-initiated repair, and in fact, the speaker fixes the thing, well, themselves. Yeah. So this is the most preferred option, because the other speaker isn't actually involved in this. There's no time for the other person to fix it. Have a look at this one. But you know, single beds are awfully thin to sleep on. What? Okay, or what? I don't know. Single beds, you mean narrow? They're awfully narrow, yeah. Okay. We have a different type of repair here. Quite obviously A says something which speaker B doesn't quite understand. Okay. In fact, this question here is already an invitation to repair. What did you mean? Okay. But the speaker A is too slow to respond or to repair themselves, and then B actually provides the repair. You mean narrow? Provides the correct way of what should have been said, so to speak. So this is an other-initiated other repair. If immediately after the turn here, the person would have said, single beds are awfully thin to sleep on. What? Oh, sorry, I meant narrow. Then that would have been an other-initiated self-repair. And you can work out for yourself what a self-initiated other repair is. Okay. Now, the other-initiated other repair is actually the least preferred option. Why is that the case? Well, because it's a face threat. We're back in pragmatics and politeness. Okay. I'm actually threatening someone's face by correcting them. Notice also that we have an interruption here. Yeah? So I'm actually imposing, in a way, on their right to speak here or on the floor. Okay? So this is actually something which is considered more of a threat to the face than a self-initiated self-repair. And this brings me to the next topic, which has to do with language and identity. This is a very general statement. Language is one of the fundamental ways in which human beings define themselves as part of a group or society. This was already, in a way, mentioned when I brought in the concept of face. And threats to someone's face in the context of language use. Language use and conversation can vary according to the status and relationships of participants in interaction. I've already talked about this in the context of politeness. This, by the way, is one of the many ways of variation, and you'll be talking a lot more about variation when you talk about social linguistics and aspects like that of language use like that next term. Now, this can be, for example, studied in the context of cross-cultural communication. For example, Finnish speakers, are there any Finns in the room? No. Okay. Finnish speakers are said to accept much longer pauses between turns than other types of speakers, let's say Americans or Germans as well. Now, as we've just seen, pauses can mean something. They can mean disagreement, they can mean agreement, or they mean also perhaps that the turn-taking system is somehow violated. Okay? That the first speaker is forced to continue, or feels forced to continue. So this can actually lead to misunderstandings, or misinterpretations, when speakers of different cultures communicate with each other. The Finnish speaker might just, well, have more to say, takes a little break, so to speak, in the eyes of the conversational partner who is not Finnish. This is a transition relevance place. The other person starts speaking. The Finnish speaker feels terribly bad about it because he feels interrupted. So you can see how miscommunication can occur there. Now, in fact, this is something quite obvious when we look at cross-cultural communication, but some linguists have worked on similar aspects of interaction in the context of, for example, male versus female conversational style. And in a way, one could argue that this is, to a certain extent, also cross-cultural communication, or something very closely related. Yeah. This is a very readable, interesting book. If you haven't read it yet, you just don't understand women and men in conversation. It's a very nice introduction to various aspects of communication. It may also help you in your relationship, because you may finally understand why your partner does certain things that you as a female or a male find rather odd. Like, for example, in a car, never ask for directions if you're male and things like that. Okay. She links certain features of general interaction, sort of non-spoken interaction, up with actual ways of communication using language. The basic claim is, because we have been brought up differently, because there are different cultures involved, okay, we have different styles. Okay. So really the claim is that we're talking about cross-cultural communication. One could say that this is a gender-like thing. Okay. It depends on your gender, whether you speak, how you speak. Okay. Now, I'm going to summarize this in a very black and white fashion now, and I'm aware of this, that it's very black and white, just to make the points quite clear. What Tannen says, basically, is that it all starts at the beginning. We've got girls and boys. Okay. They typically grow up surrounded by other girls, if they're girls, and boys, if they're, yeah, so they're more likely to associate with same-sex people. They play different games, okay, and in fact they use a different language. They, in a way, she says, grow up in different world of words. Okay. Now, as I said, this is very black and white, but I'll go on anyway. Boys are said to play outside in larger groups, and there's always a leader present. Okay. Girls tend to play, she says, in smaller groups or in pairs. Okay. People have observed from the point of view of language use, this is not just a cliché, this is actually what people have looking at lots of data, is that in boy communication, there will be different ways of giving commands among boys than among the person who might be currently, let's call it in charge in a girls' group. In fact, there will be a lot of direct insults. Okay? And there will be a lot of aspects of speech which highlight differences in status. This person is the leader, the other one isn't. Okay? While girls have been observed to use a lot more, sort of cooperative features like the actual use of the word let's, so we're supporting a common cause, stressing the equal status of the people involved, the power of community rather than the power of a single person. So basically this boils down to contest versus community. Okay. Well, what is aggression and fight for boys? Well, it's a way of initiating or facilitating friendship between boys. Okay. In fact, disagreement might signal intimacy between men. Okay. For women or girls, this is supposed to be different. We have this tendency to seek agreement, which is reflected in their role as peacemakers. Disagreement is actually something which is a threat to intimacy, so it's the opposite of what it is possibly for girls or men. Now, as I said, very black and white, but I hope you can still continue listening. What is a threat? Well, a threat to a woman in that context would then be conflict in the community. And a threat to men, loss of independence. And of course, both parties want to avoid their type of threat. But this might actually lead to a difficult situation. Misunderstandings and incomprehensions occur because those efforts of avoidance are frequently perceived as offensive by women and manipulating by men. But this is purely because their focus is supposed to be different. If men, and this is a quote from Tannen, if men see life in terms of contest, a struggle against nature and other men, for women life is a struggle against the danger of being cut off from their community. So in context of girls or women, there's supposed to be a contest of popularity, and in boys and men there is a contest of skills. Now this is sort of very general, and you could talk about this in context of sociology, etc., but of course this has an impact on the way language is used. And Tannen talks about two types of speech, or two types of speaking, as a result of those general tendencies. Rapport talks versus report talks. Talk. So, talking, having different styles as a result of this in speaking. The main problem in male-female conversation is that this is something which they don't seem to be able to change. Okay. This is something which is so much incorporated, apparently, that they cannot adjust, or they can actually not even see the difference. Okay. So it's a lack of flexibility. The more a clash of understanding becomes evident, the more both parties insist on their styles, which makes things only worse. Okay. Now, she says that when men and women talk to each other, there is therefore very often misunderstanding, or something that looks simply unfair. Okay? The realization that what seems unfair and irrational, though, may be simply the result of differences in conversational style. So, if you know about this, she says, then this may help reduce frustration, to banish blame in a relationship. I think she knows what she's talking about. I think she was married to someone who, and then got a divorce, so this is probably a result of much of what she observed in their relationship. I don't know. Also, I think he was Greek, so there might be the idea of this being cross-cultural as well. So, anyway, but I think she has a point anyway. So what she basically says is, it's essential to understand why the partner says something the way she does or he does, even if one does not see things in the same way. Now, this was all rather vague, I guess, or there were no examples. One of the examples might be if a woman, interrupts the man, or a man. Okay, what does it mean to interrupt? Okay. Or let's first have a quick look at what it means in the first place to interrupt. Well, what is an interruption? One could say that an interruption is overlap of two people speaking. One person hasn't finished speaking, the other person butts in and takes over the floor, steals things. Okay. This would be the point of view from the men, from a man's perspective. Okay. She is interrupting, she's stealing my floor. Okay. This is a competition situation. However, from the woman's point of view, it might actually be interpreted very differently. It might actually be supportive. Yeah? It might actually be just making the point, or not even wanting to take the floor, but just speaking at the same time to support the man in whatever point he is making. But because two people then speak at the same time, this feels like an interruption for the man who then stops speaking. Interruption is particularly painful in close relationships, where interrupting carries a load of meta messages. That a partner doesn't care enough, doesn't listen, isn't interested. But it may be the case that much of what is actually interpreted as an interruption was never meant as an interruption in the first place. So let's have a quick look at definitions of interruption. We could have an acoustic definition. So, one person starts speaking although the other one hasn't finished, as I said. But that is a very mechanical definition, and that doesn't do justice to what actually seems to be happening. We need, I think, a more functional definition in the sense of what does the interruption or the fact that there is overlap do in the context, what does it do to the conversation? And that actually leads to the situation that there may be an interruption without overlap. So there might be, in a conversation, a short pause, but the speaker hasn't finished, so that pause wasn't, looking back, a transition relevance place, but the other person still starts speaking. Okay. That is very different from an acoustic definition, where people might actually be cooperative, just overlap each other a little bit to make the same point, but it is in fact not an interruption. So this has to do with issues of dominance, and that's where this cooperative overlapping comes in. And maybe at the end of the lecture, you can listen to the overlaps that you hear and whether sort of the woman might be actually supporting her husband in what he's saying. There is acoustic overlap, but is it really an interruption? So it cannot be interpreted correctly on the basis of mechanical criteria. Women are said to be cooperative overlappers because of the way this reflects their upbringing and, well, all the kind of black and white things that I said before. So this is not just about the sociology of, relationships, but it's actually got an actual impact on the way people speak, and that will then sort of, bring about lots of other things. Okay. So it might actually be useful to look at how male-female interaction is ordered in order to solve some of the problems that a relationship, for example, has. This isn't, by the way, only about male-female. We can also look at, for example, Jewish New Yorkers versus Californians. There's a famous study by Deborah Tannen again that observes that they have very different conversational styles. I have two brief extracts here. This is, I hope, you can just about read this. This is a conversation between several people, and Chad is actually a Californian. He's very laid back, the way the Californians are supposed to be. He speaks more slowly than the New Yorkers, and he goes to visit in New York. He's actually taking part in a Thanksgiving dinner. Okay. All the other people know each other, and they're Jewish New Yorkers. Now, what actually happens here, you might see this, that Chad is explaining, that's what I expected to find in New York, lots of bagels. They're having sort of a social chit-chat about how he finds it in New York. Yeah, lots of bagels. When you go to Boston, you expect to find beans. And then Kurt sort of butts in and says, did you find them? No. What I found were croissant rolls and croissant and all that. He doesn't quite know how to pronounce it. Crescent rolls mostly, lots of kind of stuff, but it was... And then, what's this? This is sort of it latches on completely. It's almost like an overlap, but not quite. Where? Okay. Croissant. Okay, he finally found the word. Dave is supporting. This is other initiated, other repair. And Chad then says, I don't know. I didn't go around a whole lot for breakfast, etc. Now, what this is... One could say a normal conversation, but what actually happened is that Chad felt extremely uncomfortable. Why? Because he felt being interrupted. Did you find them? Where? When did you do this? How often did you? Etc. Yeah. This is a typical style of asking questions apparently among Jewish New Yorkers in particular. Give you another example here. This is actually Deborah Tannen herself talking to Chad when they found themselves alone by the table while everyone else was cleaning up or something like that. And Deborah Tannen wants to find out more about that person. They've never met before. You live in LA? Yes. Visiting here? Yeah. What do you do there? Work at Disney Production, well, Walt Disney. You an artist? No. Writer? Yeah, I write, etc. So she asked him later, and he actually made the point that he felt terribly imposed on. Okay? But this is not because Deborah Tannen is a nasty person, very imposing as such, but she just has a different conversational style. And she termed this the machine gun question, well, this aspect of her Jewish New Yorker style, yeah, which tends to be very typical of people in New York, a particular subgroup of people in New York, but which tends to put people, tends to be very problematic for people who are not accustomed to this style and who will then interpret this in different ways than it is intended. I, in fact, mentioned this to Anna Maria Duplan, who grew up among a lot of, within a Jewish New Yorker community. And she says, oh, now, finally, I understand. People have told me that I do those kind of things, that I constantly ask questions. And I just do this because I'm interested in finding out what's going on. And then I've been told that I ask too many questions and that I'm imposing. It's just her style. It's her, her way of speaking as someone who grew up in a community where there were a lot of Jewish New Yorkers. Tannen's claim is that we're not aware of these differences, and that will then eventually, potentially, lead to problems in interaction. Okay, that was a bit of an excursion. Let's go back to a bit more features of spoken interaction. Another feature that's very often found, and I now have to watch out that I'm not producing them, is elements of repetition, filled pauses, things like the different ways of transcribing them, either with an ER or an UH, they basically are the same. It means okay? The kind of thing that you produce a lot when you, those kind of things, yeah? When you look for words. Yeah? They're very frequent. Why do they occur? What are the reasons? Well, one reason might simply be, yes, proper hesitation. I'm not quite sure whether I should tell the other person that I've done X, for example. It might also be a transition relevance place. So it might signpost speaker turns. In fact, no speaker change, turn holding, or that I'm actually willing to yield a turn. You know, that's where we went to, I'm not saying a lot anymore, I'm just producing these hesitation markers, probably indicating that I'm quite happy to pass on the floor, to yield the floor to someone else. What shall we talk about? Well, I wanted to talk about hostages. And then the other person starts talking. So it's setting the topic, but then passing on the floor to the next person. It could also highlight something, for example, infrequent words. For 6 hours after the aromatherapy, this could be highlighting the word as something that is noticeable. It could also simply be the fact that the person finds it more difficult to retrieve the word aromatherapy from memory and therefore needs more time. So in that sense, it could be a reflection of what's going on in our brains while we speak, while we produce language online, while we create all those complex syntactic constructions that I talked about in the syntax lectures. They frequently occur at syntactic boundaries, something that I briefly mentioned, I think, in the first lecture. One interesting question is actually whether such words are real words or such utterances or such, things like or are they real words? Do they mean something in the same way as house or dog or think? Obviously not entirely, but the point is that they make a contribution to the conversation. If you remove them from a conversation, then the flow of conversation will not be the same. because, for example, they can mark transition relevance places. Okay, another question one could ask is how much of what I've said so far is actually due to non-linguistic aspects, visual clues, the fact that I'm looking at you, that I'm pointing, so gaze, body language, etc. For example, I could just stop talking now, and I could sort of point to one of you and say, start speaking, and you would probably eventually produce something. How much of our usual turn-taking is actually reliant on non-linguistic cues? Well, one easy way to find out is to look at how conversations work where there are no visual cues. Phone conversations. There are no visual cues, therefore, we would expect if visual cues are very important, turn-taking shouldn't work. Well, it does. We all know that we can perfectly well make phone conversations and we don't overlap much more, we don't interrupt each other more than we would in normal face-to-face conversations. People have looked at various things. Openings of conversations on the phone, the choice of topic, change of topic, and closing sequences. And I'll give you an example of each of these quickly. This is a typical conversation or an opening of a phone conversation. C causes the telephone to ring at R's place. Okay, R says hello, and C says hi. Oh, hi. Okay, so he's now found out who it is. Okay. Now the point to make here, okay, this is actually relevant before, for a time before everyone knew who was calling because the number is displayed. But what you could say is that the first hello is actually not the first turn, but the first hello is actually the first part of an adjacency pair. It's the answer to the summons, which is the ring. Okay? So in a way, you could say that even a non-linguistic element could be the first part of an adjacency pair. Okay? Nowadays, of course, things look different because you know who's calling, and then you may actually immediately sort of talk about something which first needed negotiation in earlier stages of communication on the phone. Looking at topics, who sets the topic? Someone calls, hello. Hello, Rob, this is Laurie. How's everything? Pretty good. How about you? Just fine. And now the topic comes. The reason I called was to ask. Yeah. Who sets the topic? This seems to be something that is pretty fixed. Okay. The person who calls, then someone picks up, etc., and then there's some sort of social chit-chat, and then the topic is set. And if that is deviated from, then it needs to be marked somehow. Then we need elements that remedy potential misunderstandings in our expected sequences. Okay. How do you change a topic on the phone? Okay, it's okay, we'll pop down tomorrow, Gertrude. Are you sure you don't? It's an awful lot of it. You quickly want to nip down now for it? Okay, I will. Hey, you, that is, have you been lighting a fire down there? Okay. It's a bit of a silly example, but the point is that this person's R actually wants to change the topic. Okay. Something was finished. Okay, I will. And then something else needs to start. But before that starts, it is actually supported by indicating there will be a topic change by various measures, or via various measures. Increased amplitude, raised pitch, markers of self-editing and hesitation, etc. Okay. Try to observe yourself when you're on the phone next time, whether you do this when you change a topic. The final thing that I want to quickly talk about is closing sequences. This is something very problematic, potentially. How do you finish a conversation on the phone? Because you should finish at the time when everyone feels, or both people feel, yeah, it's time to finish. If you finish too early, then that may carry overtones that, well, that you don't like the person or something like that. My former boss, who's Swedish, I had to get used to her conversational style. When I was on the phone with her, at some stage, she suddenly sort of, for me suddenly, said, okay, bye, and put down the receiver. And it took me weeks or months to realize, no, it's not because I did something wrong, or because it's just her way of closing phone conversations. So she had a different style, at least in that respect. And it caused me all sorts of, uneasiness at the beginning. Now, basically, I'm waiting for it, and I think, is she going to do it again? But what very often happens is actually something like this. Why don't we all have lunch? Okay, so that would be in St. Jude's, wouldn't it? Yes. Short break, short pause, I mean. Okay, so, sort of a lengthened so. 1 o'clock in the bar. Okay. Okay then, thanks very much indeed, George. All right. See you there. Okay. Bye. Now this sounds terribly artificial when I read this off. But try listening to the next conversation that you have on the phone. The kind of elaborate exchanges that happen to make sure that you're not actually stopping at a time that is too early. If you finish too early, then this carries social inference, so to speak. Over hasty and over slow terminations, also over slow, of course, can carry unwelcome inferences about the social relationship between the participants. And again, there are cultural differences, and I've already brought this to the fore with my former boss, who is Swedish, and therefore I don't know enough about Sweden, but they may all do it like that in Sweden, I don't know, but anyway. But one thing that I noticed myself was that, it's something that relates to the way Swiss people do certain things on the phone. I grew up in Switzerland, so I know a little bit about that. Swiss people, and I don't think the Germans do that to the same extent, they always thank the other person for calling. No matter whether they actually wanted something from that person and that person just called back or whatever, it's just something that you need to do. If you don't do it, then you're basically violating a rule, so to speak. Now, I wanted to try out to what extent this is actually a fixed rule, and then just basically sometimes didn't say thank you for calling. And sometimes what happened was that the other person in the correct slot said thank you too, or thank you for calling too, even though I had never thanked that person. Yeah. So it's something that is extremely fixed. We know what's happening next in this in our sort of endeavors to keep leaving the phone conversation acceptable to both people involved. Okay, so we started with adjacency pairs. We had a brief excursion on male versus female speech. We looked at hesitation markers. One element which I haven't mentioned, but which I would like to briefly mention, for which I have no slide, that is very important also in conversation, is that of back channels. What is a back channel? A back channel is not a turn, but a back channel is a little indication by the conversational partner that, yes, I'm still here, go on talking, I'm listening. So the kind of, yeah, I see, yeah, okay, those kind of things. Happen a lot, of course, in phone conversation. Try not doing this on the phone for about half a minute, and your conversational partner will say, are you still there? Mm-hmm. It's very important to signal that you're there. Mm-hmm. Now, these are not actual turns, so they are not, you don't hold the floor while you produce a back channel, but you basically just signal that the other person can keep the floor. Now, one of the interesting things is that they don't just happen anywhere. They happen at very specific places, possibly where there could have been a TRP, or where, there are slight indications that it might be interpreted as a TRP, and they are then signals to the conversational partner, yes, you can go on. Now, I'll be playing the extract on channel crossing again now. And I would like you to listen to a number of these features that I've mentioned, particularly also the back channels. Okay. At the beginning, and this is also in the transcription, you will sometimes hear that someone says, really spot on in the 0.2 second pause that the speaker makes, let's say, just breathing in. Okay. How can something be as precise as that? I mean, that is really only possible if conversation is organized in a much more rule-governed way than we think it is. Okay? So, look at, listen to that, but also listen to interruptions, listen to repairs. There are a couple of repairs in there. There is, in fact, an other-initiated other repair in there. After listening to it, I will ask you where that other-initiated other repair is. Okay? And let's just see whether you now look at or listen to that conversation in a different light from what we had before.
Act 7. Channel crossing.
So we travel the other one with the nightclub, and we had a soup cabin which was just below the nightclub. Fascinating, Andrew. You know, when you think what ours is like. When we shut our cabin door, even though there was anything outside, there was a nightclub, candle music going, just one immediately overhead, and we were the cabin next to it. And we couldn't hear it at all. And of course you could say to the children, we'd just be upstairs, and they knew they'd just have to put their dressing gown on and come up and down to it. So that was super. Okay, quite a bit of overlap. Possibly not the kind of overlap that means this is an interruption, I want to grab the floor. There are one or two instances, particularly one where she actually seems to grab the floor. Okay, but certainly, when we, and then when she finally has the floor, she restarts and then goes on telling her thing. But very often, she will actually say something, things like, yeah, or that's right, or I don't know the words now, but she's basically supporting what her husband is currently telling. Okay. Did anyone recognize, or did anyone notice what the other initiated other repair was? I actually haven't got a hand up myself, so... Okay, that would be an other initiated repair. Yes, you're right. Yes, okay. But there's one, I always have to think about that as well. There's another one, I think even more noticeable. There is one of the two men who wonders about whether it's not really a rather difficult thing to do what? To drive the car across the ferry, right? So something like that, he says. Is an awful job or something like that. And then the first thing that happens is that the other man says, what? And then he repeats it in a sort of rather incoherent fashion, but then the other person, across the channel, you mean?
Yeah, exactly, that's what I mean. So this is clearly an other-initiated, other repair, where the first person produced something that didn't make sense to the conversational partner, gave the other person first a chance to self-repair. When they didn't, he provided the what he thinks correct answer, and that was then taken up by the conversational partner and, accepted as an other repair. Yeah. But we could say that this is a more face-threatening enterprise or occasion than, if it had been a self-initiated self-repair. Okay. And I'm sure you also noticed where these little ns are located, sometimes really spot on. And maybe when you go and talk to your friends now outside, you can start noticing when they say things like mm. And then it can be very annoying when you start pointing out, oh, you just said mm, why did you do that? Okay, it's just, okay. Right, conclusion. I talked about turn-taking, talked about adjacency pairs. I made a point which I already made in the very first lecture, namely that pauses can mean something. I gave you an introduction to preferred versus dispreferred responses and how they are signaled with additional linguistic material to sort of warn the people involved, oh, something is about to happen which I'm not going to like. I then gave you an excursion onto, the reasons why men and women speak differently, okay, or at least supposed to have certain differences in their style. Okay. I then took this as a way to talk more about interruptions and interpreting interruptions, and I ended with phone conversations. Next week, we'll be doing corpus linguistics, okay, which is one of the methods of doing linguistics. So far, what we've done is we've looked at the different levels of linguistic analysis, starting from the smallest possible units up to suprasentential elements and to the way utterances in conversation hold together or mean things in context. Next week, I would like to introduce you to the method that many of us in the department, or actually most of us linguists, do a lot of. Namely, we're looking at large collections of texts or corpora in electronic format, and you can do morphology, you can do syntax, you can do pragmatics, you can do all sorts of aspects of linguistics with the help of corpora, and that's why I would like to give you a brief introduction. And those of you who are in Professor Stubbs' lecture will already have seen quite a lot of what you can do with corpora there. I have just uploaded the reading for you, and it's basically a brief introduction to corpus linguistics that I will then build up on next time in the last lecture. So, see you next Friday.